Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Pluto TV, by the way, is the leading free streaming television service. You watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed, no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and your hit movies. So what are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Pluto TV is free on all of your favorite devices. Download Pluto TV today.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Okay, if you missed, and you probably did because you're doing other things, if you missed President Trump's rally in Pennsylvania on Monday night, well, you missed a doozy. This campaign is going to be wild. And I cannot, can you believe we're already doing the 2020 campaign? I mean, it seems like it began, well, it did begin the moment after Trump won. And we've just been on a perpetual campaign ever since, not because of him, but because the left has been absolutely gnashing its teeth to try to get back into power. And so now we have 10,000 people running for the Democrat nomination. And one by one, I think the president is just having fun. It's like one of those little games at the arcade. It's like, bing, 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 knock it over, knock it over, knock it over. But it's not whack-a-mole because I don't think most of them are coming back up. Oh, by the way, before we get any further today, I want to thank all of our sponsors, among them Pluto TV, Cerovital, and Delta Animal Rescue. They help to provide this podcast free for you every week. Support them. We love them. You'll love these products. Pluto TV, Cerovital, and Delta Animal Rescue. So this is just a knockdown, bing, bing, bing. And last night, right off the bat, it was. I like calling him Ramblin' Joe. But I'll go with Trump's Sleepy Joe.
Sleepy Joe said that he's running to, quote, save the world. Well, he was. He's going to save every country but ours. And remember, he said a week ago, China's not a competitor. China's not a competitor. You know, hey, look. What they've done to us is indescribable economically. We have rebuilt China. We allowed it to happen. Our leaders allowed it to happen. Well, it's not happening anymore. Iran and we have saved America. We made America great again, and we're going to keep America great. That's what it is.
He had 10,000 people on a Monday night in Pennsylvania. Remember when Pennsylvania was supposed to be his Waterloo in 2016. Expert after expert appeared on television to tell us, oh, well, remember the old days when Republicans could win in Pennsylvania? Well, those days have passed us by. And of course, he wins Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio and Florida and Arizona and, you know, one after the other. These so-called experts should have never been heard from again. But these are the same experts now who are telling us that Joe Biden is the answer to what ails us. Now, in a moment, I'm going to tell you what is supposedly ailing our economy, and then you'll laugh. But he continued.
But he announced he's running for president, and he said it's because foreign leaders called him up and begged him to do it. Absolutely. Foreign countries liked it. Much better. That's what they want. They want Biden so that China can continue to make $500 billion a year and more, ripping off the United States. They like it.
Oh, making China great again. Oh, what we have to see from honest journalists, I know that's an oxymoron, real questions to Biden that allow for no wiggle room. Will you lobby Congress to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership when you become president, if you, heaven forbid, became president? Would you do away with the president's tariffs to try to recalibrate the marketplace vis-a-vis China's unrepentant dumping and subsidies, all the things they do, stealing intellectual property? Would you do away with the tariffs? Would you push forward with the USMCA, the new NAFTA deal? Yeah, you can't let him get away with this because Biden is the kind of guy who one day to the next, I think he doesn't even remember what he said the previous day. He'll just speak to whatever audience he's speaking to. And he's like, well, these people are going to probably like me to be tougher on China. So I'm going to try to be tougher on China. But when Biden comes forward and says that, yeah, man, hey, man, I've been asked by these foreign leaders to run. And they said, Joe, come on, Joey, run. I thought to myself, if China wants me to run, I'm going to run. No, you can imagine. Can you imagine President Xi having the chance to sit across the table from Biden and Biden's negotiators, who are going to be the same people as Obama's negotiators were, basically the same type of folks? Oh my gosh, he's rubbing his hands together going, when can we get back to the status quo when we could write our own ticket into the future? And President Trump is absolutely right on that. That's what's at stake. Our future as a country, our economy, our position vis-a-vis the CCP, Chinese Communist Party. And for the life of me, I don't know why we have Democrats who supposedly care about human rights jumping on the China bandwagon. Do you understand that? And these libertarians, we'll get into this buffoon Justin Amash. I'm going to call him Justin Amush because it's like mush between his ears. Justin Amush, who is the president should be impeached. A lot of people are thinking he might run for libertarian as a libertarian candidate to try to, what is he going to try to do with that? Win? No, he's going to try to throw it to the Democrats. But why are libertarians thinking China is going to be, this is ultimately going to end well for us? I'm not a libertarian. Everyone knows that. I'm an old school. Call me paleo conservative. I don't care what, but I'm a Reagan conservative. He was in some people say he was a libertarian. I don't think so. Reagan was a, and I know people say that. I love Craig Shirley. He's my dear friend. He would say he was a libertarian. So you think Reagan would be all on board with pot legalization nationwide, and Reagan would be on board with, you know, what we've seen with redefining, you know, gender? And of course he wouldn't be. I mean, he wouldn't be for any of that. Now, it doesn't mean you necessarily do a federal cram down on everything, so I agree on that. But the libertarians, they should be pretty thrilled with Trump. I mean, I don't like the spending. The spending is where, you know, I want to reform all these entitlements, but it's like nobody wants to do that because it's a really hard thing. You have to do that in your second term because then at that point you want to go for broke on everything. But I don't see where the libertarians think electing Joe Biden is going to get them. That's not going to get them closer to whatever nirvana with drugs and open borders. And how is that going to – it's not going to end well for libertarians where they're basically low-tax, small government people. If you think government's growing too much under Trump, can you imagine what it's going to do under Kamala Harris or Biden?
And especially when it comes to foreign policy, libertarians should love Trump.
Oh, my God. Exactly. I can't believe I just forgot to say that. Absolutely right. Non-interventionist. You know, I still think we're spending too much money on weapon systems that we might not need. And I wish we could cut back. But given the China spending, we do have to keep pace with China. But Raytheon and Northrop Grumman should not run our economy. Our economy has to run on medium, small businesses, big businesses too often want to offshore their production overseas. It's easier for them to do that in some cases, and they've rushed to do that, and they've cashed in big time. So a lot of these people are making stuff over in China, and they don't want to be inconvenienced by either having to bring it back here or go to Malaysia or go to Vietnam or these other places. But look, it's better for stuff to be made. If it's not going to be made here, it's better for stuff not to be made in China because that just raises their GDP and makes them more powerful. And yet another good metric for President Trump, a friend of mine sent me this today from Gallup. And this number is so good that it's hard to see, absent some massive calamity, it's hard to see the American people pulling the lever for someone like Biden or Harris or whomever. Americans' view of the job market hits a new high. This is today, Gallup. So Americans' confidence in the U.S. job market is the highest in Gallup's trend originating in 2001, with 71% in May saying now is a good time to find a quality job. This represents a significant improvement from March and April, when 65% each month rated the job market favorably. Today's level is similar to February's 69% reading. Now, I said this on the Ingram angle. If you want to work, you can get a job today. And if you want to work hard and you want to show everybody in the workplace that you have a great work ethic and you're going to come to the table with something every day, you'll get a good job. I mean, it won't take you long. This economy is, it's never been better. Not in, and people say Reagan administration. I don't think so. This is a hot, hot economy, and there's no sign of inflation on the horizon, which is really where it's at. So we don't have to worry about inflation. So that in and of itself is an unbelievable, it's an unbelievable metric. Now, back in 2001, in August, this is before 9/11. So Bush comes in and he does the tax cut in the summer of 2001. It's right before 9/11. The job market was rated at 39%. So this is when we have rising unemployment, recession concerns. Basically, things started leveling off over the next 16 years. But it was, you know, the numbers were fairly bad. Of course, 2009, 10, 11, when the market was just wasn't great. There were improvements under Obama, but the market wasn't great. So optimism about the job market has gone up since 2011. But more recently, the percentage of Americans viewing the job market positively first surpassed 60% during Trump, September 2017, and averaged 65% last year. It's now at 71%. This is just joke. If this is unbelievable news. So this is how Biden is explaining this all away.
I know President Trump likes to take credit for the economy and the economic growth and the low unemployment numbers. But just look at the facts, not the alternative facts. President Trump inherited an economy from Obama-Biden administration that was given to him, just like he inherited everything else in his life.
Oh, really? So let's talk about the average GDP in your first 2 years and last 2 years compared to Trump. Well, okay, let's talk about how fast you grew the economy and your GDP numbers. You were limping along for your last year. It was a limp. It wasn't a gallop. It wasn't even a canter. Okay? Donald Trump has demonstrated that a tight labor market, low unemployment, a tight labor market, tariffs are part of this, tough on China, American focus, the tax cut, deregulation, this was all going to lead to a renaissance in America. Oil and gas, biotech, bringing businesses, incentives to stay here, thrive here, grow here, doing deals that encourage other countries to bring their operations here. All this was positive. Obama was out there saying we're never getting manufacturing back. That was Obama's line in the second term of his presidency. Oh, I'm going to wave a magic wand and you get these jobs back. Oh, yeah. No, he didn't do that. He did some hard work. Had good people. That's what he did. You're listening to the Laura Ingram Podcast. I want to thank all of our great sponsors who make this podcast possible every single day. And I have a question for you. Are you experiencing any sleep loss or lack of energy? You don't think your skin looks as good as it can? Well, it's probably a sign that you are experiencing a dip in your HGH or your human growth hormone. You know, it happens naturally when people age. It's just a fact of life. But here's some good news. Serovital is clinically shown to increase your body's natural production of HGH to levels closer to what you experienced back in your 20s and 30s. And they now have Serovital Advanced, and that delivers all the benefits of the original formula plus accelerated skin improvements and weight loss as little as 15 days for some folks, which I love reading these testimonials. So listeners to this podcast can get 20% off their Serovital order. Just go to serovital.com. That's S-E-R-O-V-I-T-A-L.com. Use the promo code Laura. So you get 20% off your purchase. This is great. S-E-R-O-V-I-T-A-L. And use that promo code Laura. Very easy. So you start looking, feeling younger. It just don't do anything to your body that you're going to regret later. But do the right thing now. With Sero Vital Advanced, order today. You'll even get free shipping. Again, serovital.com, promo code L-A-U-R-A.
Our politicians, our politics today, traffics in division. And our president is the divider in chief.
Oh, yeah!
Look, he's just the worst practitioner of politics that singles out, scapegoats, and demonizes. He holds out the other as a source of all their problems. You hear it. The immigrant, the Muslim, anyone different in creed or color or conviction, they're the problem. That's what he says.
Isn't this kind of what Hillary tried? Didn't Hillary run on the same exact platform? He's a divider. I'm a uniter. We're keeping the country focused on the one he wants to separate. And meanwhile, at the end of Obama's term, America found us more polarized along racial lines than when he started. So after 8 years of Obama, America was more divided. And then Trump's the problem? Well, I think that's a really tricky way of trying to win the presidency.
And remember, Hillary's slogan was stronger together and Biden's is united. It is the exact same thing.
Oh, my God. I wonder if he's going to have that Scooby-mobile that used to whisk Hillary away when she started having those odd moments. Remember that on 9/11? I felt bad for her. She kind of fell into the Scooby van. They whisked her away. Then she appeared magically later, like five blocks away. That was odd, the flower.
She like hugged a little kid, too.
Remember it was like something out of former Soviet Union, like all stage managed. It was weird. But Trump is the Energizer Bunny, you have to admit. Like, that man does not sleep, and I think it is a testament to a man who doesn't drink and never drank and never smoked. I that's the only thing I can think of. How does he have so much energy? But this is the best thing I've heard ever. Biden is going to keep America what? United again? That's going to be his... And, oh, sorry, the booming economy was 71%, according to Gallup, today... 71% are optimistic about the job market, say it's a strong job market. That's all because of Obama and Biden. Joining us now, one of my absolute favorites. And I love having him on the podcast because we have actual time versus our 4 minutes on TV, which we also love. But I need Victor Davis Hanson in long form. He's my favorite long form performer. He joins us now. VDH's book, of course, The Case for Trump. Awesome. And such a phenomenal writer. We have important anniversaries coming up after Memorial Day with the Normandy invasion anniversary, the Korean anniversary. There's so much going on, so we want to talk to him about all of this. VDH, how you doing? Good to talk to you, my friend.
Very good. Very good. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, so Biden yesterday was it yesterday we were speaking? Yeah, Biden yesterday
Saturday.
Oh, sorry. It was on Saturday, his real kickoff of his campaign. I thought he kicked it off weeks ago. It's kind of his real kickoff. So Biden comes out and says, well, this is our economy. This is the Obama-Biden economy. Does that fly in any way, shape, or form?
No, but what is he going to run on? I mean, is he going to say the stock market's too high or GDP is too high or unemployment's too low or are we producing too much oil and gas? Or if he looks abroad, he's not going to be able to say, God, we got to get back in that Paris Accord, or we got to get that embassy back to Tel Aviv, things like that. So the only thing he can say is the manner in which we're succeeding is kind of icky or creepy or Trump tweets too much. And that's the narrative that he has. The problem, I think, is Trump at 72 is 60 and Biden at 77 is about 80 or 90. And second, he's a divider. I mean, he's the guy who on two occasions said he was going to take Trump behind the gym and beat him up. And he's got a whole history of gaffes and racialist comments. And then besides all that, he's failed twice. So he's a front runner, but he has a history of being a kind of a popular media candidate and then imploding. But you can see, and I don't really buy the idea that the Democratic Party is suddenly centrist. And that he represents, that's why he's ahead, because I think he's just the only person there that's running on a halfway, or maybe a quarterway, same platform. But if you combine all the others, their votes are more than Biden. And so he's viable as long as all of these leftists are in the race. But when you start to see them drop out and you get a Bernie versus him or Elizabeth Warren versus him or I don't know who else, but
Kamala.
Then I think it's not going to be, he's not going to be good old Joe of the 1980s, which he's now apparently is trying to renounce and repudiate anyway.
Well, yeah. Well, he yesterday came out for doing away with the Hyde Amendment. So that's how radical the man has turned. And I don't even think he believes that, but he feels like he has to mouth that. So now American taxpayers are going to have to pay for abortions overseas. Do you think people who are even pro-choice want that? I don't get that at all. How is that a winning
position? I don't either. And then on the late-term abortion and the near end, the de facto infanticide, it's like Dr. Gosnell never broke any laws. You know what I mean? He just did what they're advocating. And that's what I don't understand. That was so repulsive, that case of him actually destroying children as they were in the womb and outside the birth canal. And yet they're saying, well, it's a very small percentage and what, 6,000 or 7,000 incidents per year. That's more than people die of particular types of cancer every year. But I don't understand that position other than what you suggest, that whoever gets in the general election, they're going to try to moderate it. And like Mayor Pete did the other day when he said, well, Jefferson, I don't mean that I'm going to take his name off everything, but that's exactly what he meant. And so they say certain things, and then like all politicians are going to have to modulate them. But the $64,000 question, how crazy will they sound, and can they repudiate how they sound in the general election? But so far, I don't think they're doing a very good job of it, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, again, he has had quite a spectacular transformation in his views. We're talking about Joe Biden with Victor Davis Hanson here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. And like so many Democrats on issues of trade, on issues of China, on issues of interventionism, on issues of even sanctuary cities. This was Biden in 2007. Let's listen.
I'd like to hear from Senator Biden. Would you allow these cities to ignore the federal law?
The reason the cities ignore the federal law is the fact that there is no funding at the federal level to provide for the kind of enforcement at a federal level you need. Part of the problem is you have to have a federal government that can enforce laws.
So, Senator Biden, yes or no, would you allow the cities to ignore the federal law?
No.
Yeah, so, okay, so he said no, he wouldn't. But today, of course, they're the great heroes of our, against our dictatorial, immigration system, the sanctuary cities.
Yeah, but that was almost a decade ago, so we've had about 800,000 people come into the United States. And so we're talking about almost 10 million, 11 million people that are here. And so this whole democratic metamorphosis is based on electoral reality. A lot of these people have got green cards, or they're de facto voting in local election, or their children now, or some of them were came here at 5 illegally there, or they were born here. So we have a whole new generation. So for the Democratic Party, it has nothing to do with whether you want a sovereign nation and closed borders and states to follow federal law, but flipping Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada blue. And they think it's a pretty good strategy. And they're never, ever going to go back to what we just heard from Joe Biden, at least not in our lifetime, because they feel that there's no, I don't know, the La Raza ethnic lobby doesn't want it. Mexican government doesn't want it. The Democratic operatives don't want it. And so there's nothing in it for them other than principle and patriotism. And they're not big on that. So it's going to get even crazier. But it is interesting when you play that to see that when the numbers weren't quite as acute as they are now, they sounded reasonable. At least some of them did.
Well, we found out through a report yesterday that a third of migrants faked family relationship with the children they crossed the border with. That doesn't surprise me at all. When I was in Del Rio, Texas, a couple weeks ago, I spoke to a few of the migrants that the kids looked really uncomfortable, more so than just being in a foreign place. But there's something in their eyes didn't look right. So I went up and started talking to them in Spanish. And I mean, I can't, what am I? I can't do anything. I'm just a citizen, like, reporting on it. But if I had to bet, I would have bet those kids had no relationship with the adult they were with. They were scared. They were scared kids. Scared beyond just being in a foreign country.
It's a general rule that almost everything we hear about illegal immigration, unfortunately, is not accurate. About the numbers, about the circumstances under which people come as quote-unquote refugees, about the degree of criminality that occurs among illegal immigrants. It's just not true, and it's considered a noble lie that what does it matter if the real truth is that we're going to let, you know, deserving people in the United States. That's the narrative. And I live it every day, Laura. When I go out, I'm told that illegal immigrants do not throw trash. They would never do that. And I pick up mounds of trash out in front of my farm. I have the addresses of the people. They put their power bills in. I know exactly where they live. The sheriff doesn't do anything. I have 6 dogs right now that were dumped on my property. So that's not, it's not a big thing, but that's what happens when you have large numbers of unassimilated immigrants who came in illegally in large numbers, that are not diverse. It would really work if we had people coming from Korea or Africa or Europe, all coming legally, all in measured numbers, all mixed up, and they would assimilate. But that's not what's happening. We're getting huge groups of one language, one culture coming
across
the border illegally. The first thing they do is break the law. The second thing they do is reside illegally and break the law. So, and they know it. And so their attitude is, if I break the law in coming and I break another law in residing, why do I have to follow any other laws? And they feel a sense of exemption. I talk to them. You know, I've taken trash and said, don't throw it on here, and delivered it to their house. And the attitude is, why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. So I think basic human nature says if somebody is exempt, at no point does he feel that he should not be exempt from any other law.
In Guatemala, where I've spent the most time, Salvador in the 80s, but Guatemala most recently, what's shocking is both how beautiful the country is, spectacularly beautiful, mountains, water, lakes, ancient villages and cities, the ancient capital, and how there is, and it's part of this corrupt government and no sense of civic pride because of the way things have gone for so long there. But people just take their trash and dump it down pristine ravines. I'm talking about waterfalls and beautiful rainforest-like terrain. And my daughter and I are driving up this mountain about 4 hours outside of Guatemala City. The trash is just dumped. I mean, like, just and again, it's just like a forest, and you see mounds of trash just dumped along a ravine, down a ravine. And then what happens at the border? We're at the Rio Grande. Trash is everywhere on the Mexican side. There's trash, but when they cross, they just dump all their stuff on the path that they cut through the bamboo like weeds that are along the border, and they just trash everywhere. And it's just a different mentality. I mean, for them, it's not a big deal. They don't. Well, that's just what we did in Guatemala.
I don't understand, though, our attitude, because existentially their decision was, things are not going well for me and my family in Mexico, or especially Central America. I don't like the protocols. It doesn't give me freedom, security, economic opportunity. And so I'm going to come to take a big risk and come in illegally to a different country. That's the antithesis of everything I'm leaving behind. And yet when I come into the new country, I have no immediate desire to adopt the very protocols that will make me secure, prosperous, and free in a way I wasn't at home. And then we, the host, allow that to happen. In the old days, you had to be assimilated very quickly and integrated. But why would anybody want to come and replicate the conditions of their own country they're fleeing from? That's what doesn't make sense about the... I think that's what bothers everybody, and that's why Trump's ideas about immigration appeal to people. It wasn't that they were anti-foreigner. They were pro-law, and they wanted people to embrace a country that they'd already chosen to enter. And yet when they entered, there were certain ideas or attitudes or protocols that suggested that they were owed something, or they were not going to readily become American, or they were going to be part of the identity politics industry. And that's really foreign to the idea of the melting pot. And people rebel against that. They find it ingratitude. They find it unacceptable. And that's what gets people really fired up. I know that when I'm here and I'm not a very emotional guy, but when I go in town and I go to my cleaner and everybody's speaking Spanish and the cars in the parking lot all have Mexican flags on.
Oh, yeah.
And people walk out of the cleaners and they throw their McDonald's sack right on the gutter. It gets me really angry.
Oh, no, I get
enraged.
You know what I do? This happens in D.C. all the time. And I'm going to get myself hurt. I know I'm going to get myself. You know what I do? I pick it up and then I say, oh, excuse me, you dropped something. My kids are like, you're going to get killed. But it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
I'm a conservationist. I love animals and nature. And I don't care if you're American or whatever you are. But this idea that you can just throw stuff on the ground. But again, it's like the broken windows theory. It's the same thing. You're right. When you violate a law and you're rewarded for it with access and entrance and a paper. So when they cross the border, what happens, Victor, we're talking to Victor Davis Hanson. What happens is they get taken to a processing center. They're separated by, okay, this is a family unit. All your family units are here. The single males, adults, are over here. Then you have the teenagers, unaccompanied minors here. Then you have the young unaccompanied minors, and not many of those, but they're all separated in separate rooms, right? Then once they're processed, they are given a piece of paper, and it's basically a government sheet from DHS, Department of Homeland Security, that allows them to travel. Like even people who don't have an identification, they're allowed to travel on planes because most of them come without any ID.
I don't understand it. Yesterday I was talking to somebody in my community, and they're having a new law, as you know, in California that you have until fall of 2020 to get a new driver's license that will allow you to travel. California's don't anymore because we allow illegal aliens to have them. This person was telling me that her brother and she can't get one because they use different names and they've never really had to have an accurate name. They're illegal. But I said to them, if I used a false name and a false social security number, do you realize I'd be fired from where I work?
She said, really?
I said, yes, I would. And I guess, again, that asymmetry that people, when they have all these fake names and fake IDs, we say, well, that's what we make them do, or that's what they have to do. And you say, no, that's a felony. And every other American is asking for equity under the law, and they're not getting it because they abide by a set of rules. And for some reason, people who enter the country illegally don't have to abide by the same rules that citizens do. It's like we've just said, there's no difference between citizenship and residency. They're the same thing, and especially not illegal residency. It really erodes the whole old ancient idea of being a citizen. That was a privilege, and there were certain rights and responsibilities. And it doesn't matter anymore. You're just simply on American soil. You get counted in the census. You can vote in a local election. The law doesn't apply to you through a particular group. And it's really scary because when you lose the idea of the privilege of citizenship, then you don't have a country.
No, well, it doesn't mean anything. It's diluted. And a lot of people think, well, what's the point? Like, if you're an illegal immigrant, you can get a scholarship to school. You get a scholarship to a college.
Absolutely.
Dartmouth and all these schools, they're all giving scholarships to people who are undocumented. So
one of my big frustrations was teaching at Cal State Fresno for 22 years and having Hispanic students from Arizona and Nevada who paid three times the in-state tuition rate as out-of-state legal American citizens, and then illegal aliens in my classes in California that were paying one-third the cost of a U.S. citizen from a different state. And it got them very angry, and it was crazy.
Victor,
it's gone
before
so far now, it's been institutionalized.
Right. They want people to be numb to it. Well, what are you going to do? And throw up your hands, and what are you going to do? Before we let you go, Victor, I have to ask you about Trump versus China. Biden obviously has forgotten. He changes his comment day to day, depending on what audience he's speaking to. But Biden obviously has to be pressed on the Trans-Pacific Partnership because he and Obama are all for it. Hillary, you know that it wasn't popular because Hillary ran against it. So Biden's gotten away with not even coming out on it one way or another on the TPP so far.
No, he hasn't. And he said China's not a threat. And then we had this big psychodrama about Huawei and the telecommunications giant. But what we didn't even talk about is this month alone, I think the guy's name was Lee and Mallory. We had two pretty high-ranking CIA agents that both pled guilty to China espionage. I'm within the CIA, right in a Virginia court. And then this whole thing about, well, Trump is, ginning up an argument. I can remember during the Obama period when Michael Hayden, the CIA director, 2013, said, wow, we can't have anybody in the intelligence agencies using any Huawei telecommunications devices because they're not secure and their data networks will transmit information to China. And there's no difference between that company and the Chinese government. And then I remember, I don't know if you remember that, but Obama's head of cybersecurity is now Huawei's greatest lobbyist in the United States. So China's insidious. They have so much power, and they hide behind, almost as if they're hiding. When you call them out, they say, well, you're racist, or, identity politics arguments, or they use libertarian economic thinkers or departments in the United States, and they say, you know what, deficits don't matter, or we're giving cheap goods to the American middle class, or you're right, this is not sustainable, and it makes you more competitive. But they're like a chameleon. They just absorb all these American arguments to justify this asymmetrical cheating on trade and this mercantile trajectory. And it's really scary. How many people in the United States are apologists for it?
Now, do you notice that Canada is even getting nervous about the Chinese investment there? There's a big piece I tweeted out from the Globe and Mail, a big editorial about how Canadians are being bamboozled by the promise of China. With connections to China comes real costs. It's not just an economic opportunity; it's also a threat. I mean, Trump, you and I were so far ahead of the curve on China. It's like not even funny. It's like decades and decades ahead of everyone else. But yeah, it's nice to see that finally, people are beginning to wake up, even if not Joe Biden in the moment. But a lot of people are waking up to China.
No, they're right. They are. Where I work at the Hoover Institution, you never heard anything, but China's just has a few speed bumps on its way to Carmel. And now all of a sudden, wow, the more money we gave them, they didn't liberalize. The more money we gave them, they became more authoritarian at home and abroad. And this is bad. And all, I can't believe the people at Stanford University that are suddenly, after Trump threw the rock in the Chinese window, that they feel liberated. Of course, they never mention the word Trump for their new audacity, but that's the reason that they're suddenly coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah. Well, VDH, it's great to talk to you. We got to talk to you before the June 6th D-Day invasion anniversary, and also we talk about Korea as well. So we still have a lot to talk about. But thank you so much for joining us. We love having you on. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Make sure, by the way, if you want to be part of this program, that you email us at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Let's go to Bob in Massachusetts. Bob.
Hello.
Hey, Bob, go ahead.
I'm just concerned or curious if there's any kind of platform for Joe Biden besides we hate that guy. And it seems like that's all he has when he speaks to the tens of people at every gathering he seems to have so far.
Yeah, I don't see what the argument is. If they have an argument, they're not really making the case very strongly. I mean, their argument is Trump's a bad person and I'm a nice person. That's basically it. He tweets things that he shouldn't tweet, and he called certain countries assholes, and he said there were some good people protesting against the removal of Robert E. Lee statue, so he's a bad person. I mean, to me, that's kind of it. I mean, they don't really have another argument. What are they going to say? The economy's on fire. They try to take credit for it. No, it's not believable. I mean, none of it is believable to me. By the way, Kamala Harris was speaking before the NAACP last week, and this is her lame attempt at a rebrand.
This guy in the White House said neo-Nazis were fine people when they marched on Charlottesville.
Not what he said.
He's attacked communities of color and leaders of color by name. Let's speak truth here and today. This president isn't trying to make America great. He's trying to make America hate.
He's trying to make America hate. I'm going to work on my Kamala accent. I think I can do that impersonation. I just need another week or so. It's so lame. So Donald Trump has done more to help the African-American community with this vibrant economy than any number of government programs promised by liberals or instituted by liberals in recent years that I can think of. I mean, or unless you want to compare Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative with a booming economy. Okay, if you think Obama did more for just practically speaking for job opportunities and, of course, the revitalization program, the First Step, the Second Step Act, the criminal justice reform, I mean, economic opportunity zones. I mean, my goodness, what else could you do in 2 years? That's with a Mueller probe. It's never going to be good enough because he doesn't want to make America great again. I don't think that's going to work. I mean, if that's their backup plan for Joe Biden, I don't know. That's not going to be a... Mark in Ohio. Mark.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
My comment is the 2020 radical left, what I like to call them, they do not have any policies or platforms. Their number one mission is to take Trump out at all cost mm-hmm. and total government control of all of our lives. And I don't think the average working man and woman in this country knows what's at stake with their paychecks if they were to ever get power.
Yeah, well, I think that's what Trump's he's just starting, really, his campaign now. He had his big rally in Philadelphia, or outside of Philadelphia last night. Was it outside of Philly? Where was it? Was it in Western Pennsylvania?
Yeah, Western Pennsylvania.
Okay. So he has his big Pennsylvania rally, and he basically says, look, they're coming for your wallet. They're going to talk about all these other, what they're really going to do is take your money and give it to other people. They're going to give it to more illegal immigrants. They're going to give it to people who don't want to work. And Trump's whole argument is going to be, how is it going to get better than this? What are they arguing that's going to make your life better? What policies are they arguing for? Free stuff? Well, we know you eventually run out of other people's money. There are a lot of interesting things, by the way, and I appreciate that call. There are a lot of interesting things happening in Canada, which we are going to get into with our next guest coming up, Conrad Black, who was just pardoned by President Trump. And this was announced last week. Everyone knows that Conrad is a very old friend of mine and just a brilliant thinker, writer, historian, formerly a media baron in Canada, owned a bunch of newspapers, both in the United States, Canada, and Britain, Jerusalem Post as well. And so we're going to talk to him in just a moment. But I also want to remind you about Delta Animal Rescue. This is an amazing group that takes care of abandoned animals, especially animals that have been left in the wilderness. You know, people just dump dogs off, dump cats, they drive somewhere where they don't think anyone will see them and they dump things. Dump people, people dump animals, okay? They don't dump people. I mean, yeah, they do dump people, but this is about animals. And Delta Rescue is incredible. They have the largest no-kill and care for life animal sanctuary of its kind in the world. The super sanctuary is home to more than 1,500 animals, and they've all been abandoned in the wilderness. So you can help them, and a great way to help them, I mean, I donate to them just as a matter of course regularly because I love what they do. 100% of the donations go directly to the animals, so you don't have this big administrative cost or any of that. Another great way to give is to think about just inserting them in your estate planning. Eventually, you know, we're going to go. We're all going to go. You can't take it with you. Try to give something to groups that do great work. And this is a phenomenal group of people. DeltaRescue.org/Laura. Just go there. DeltaRescue.org/Laura. Learn more about how you can greatly benefit these innocent creatures, God's creatures, in your estate planning. Again, donate today at DeltaRescue.org/Laura. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Delighted you're with us. We've had, so far, an amazing conversation with Victor Davis Hanson on the 2020 race, its implications for American sovereignty, continuing this gangbusters economy, Your own freedom. Freedom to make your own decisions for yourself and your family. And freedom from government coercion. With everything we're seeing today, from the Democrats to force people into this viewpoint of gender transformation. Like, parents have to buy into all of this. Otherwise, they're going to run into trouble in public schools. There are strange, strange things happening and very disturbing as the Democrats become ever radicalized in the face of an increasingly popular Trump. 51% of Americans polled in the new Gallup survey approve of the way he's handling the economy. 71% reporting that the economy is strong, the job market is strong. That is a record since Gallup's began measuring that back in August of 2001. These numbers are high. Now, his approval rating still not where I think anyone wants it to be, but frankly, it was low when he was running in 2016, and he still won. We have news across the pond, the big EU vote on Thursday, which I have been following religiously because there's a lot at stake against the traditional parties in the EU, and people are waking up to the problem of globalism and open borders, and it's a huge problem in countries like Sweden and Italy and so forth. So we'll talk about that. Also, Canada waking up to the perils of Chinese investment, relying on Chinese investment. So we're reading about that in various publications today. So Trump's been ahead of the curve on a lot of this stuff, and people are kind of now waking up to the threat of a rising China. Joining us now, Conrad Black. He's a member of the British House of Lords. He's taken a bit of a break from that. But he's the author of Donald J. Trump, A President Like No Other. And, of course, a historian, so many phenomenal books on FDR, Nixon, and columnist, writer, businessman. He joins us now. And now he can finally come back to the United States after being pardoned by President Trump. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Conrad, how are you feeling? You feeling good?
Feeling very well, thanks, Laura. Very well.
You were a
by
big
By the way,
hit.
In your summary, you might have mentioned the Australian election.
It's on my pile.
It was an absolute foregone conclusion the left would win with this preposterous commitment to stripping the resource business, which is the entire economy of Australia, to fight climate change, and they lost.
Yeah, I mean, that's on the top of mind.
A guy who appeared in front of the parliament buildings with a block of coal in his hand was reelected.
Yeah, so Scott Morrison. And that's again, right. So this is, people say, well, it's Trumpism. No, it's. I think it's realism. Don't you think this is like a realistic approach to the way the world is, not the way you hope the world would turn out if China was given all this freedom?
Of the material well-being of the voters with the scheme laid out for them by the elites of how they should live. Never mind that the elites themselves will not live that way. And, fortunately, this is when democracy is vindicated, that these daffy, self-elevated, ruling classes we seem to develop in all societies are holding a steering wheel that isn't connected to anything. And that's the salvation of the whole system.
Yeah, so voters rejecting down under this sweeping Labor Party platform that Conrad Black just referenced, moving the nation dramatically leftward, if implemented, everything from higher taxes to increased benefits for indigenous people and carbon emissions reductions and so forth, is just roundly rejected. I mean, there's really no way to try to spin this as anything but a complete repudiation of radical leftism.
By a sophisticated democratic electorate. It's an advanced, prosperous country, and they weren't having it.
Conrad, I want to talk, before we get into Canada, I do want to talk about Thursday's EU elections, because you elect these members of the European Parliament, and people in the United States probably are like, oh, God, why do we care about this? Why do we care? Why should Americans care about what ultimately goes down on Thursday for these elections in Brussels, given what Nigel Farage is trying to do with Brexit, and given the challenges that we're seeing in Italy and Spain and even places like Sweden, which were traditionally very leaning socialist, what's happening across the board there that we in the United States should take note of?
Well, I think you've got 2 points. The immediate point is sorting out the British relationship. And Nigel Farage, as I imagine most of your listeners know, was the leader of the Brexit Party, the United Kingdom Independence Party it was, which should not be confused with the British National Party, who are skinheads and hooligans.
Right, horrible.
Nigel Farage is a very sensible person, very respectable. And now, having won the referendum, he retired. And now he's come back leading a Brexit party in the elections for the European Parliament. I mean, for a time, we had a separatist party in Quebec being the leading party representing Quebec in our federal parliament, from which they wanted to secede. I mean, you get these absurd situations. Now, we settled that whole separatist thing in Quebec, all right. But in this case, it is going to be an incitement to others in Europe, because the great structural problem of Europe, and this is the second point. I mean, I'll finish this. When Nigel wins, as he's going to do, it is going to put increased heat on the parliamentarians in London to resolve this problem. I mean, the fact is, the country by a narrow margin wants to leave Europe. And the parliament that is there doesn't want to leave, and you can't get a majority from them. So the answer is to let the deadline run out in October, and in the meantime, replace Mrs. May with Boris Johnson. I think that will happen. But the second point, the bigger point that Americans who follow these things should be interested in, is that Europe itself is in a very deteriorating situation. The basic problem, I think, is that the government, the so-called government of the European Union in Brussels, does not answer to the major states, Germany, France, Britain, and Italy, and it does not answer to this ridiculous parliament that is having its election this week. It has no authority, and no one listens to it. It's a debating society. So it isn't really democracy. It's a bunch of Belgians and Dutch and Luxembourgers, and we're all unlicensed psychiatrists, and I've met many of these people over many years, and I think they are taking out the frustrations of generations as citizens of little countries have been ordered about by the Germans, French, and British, and are just trying to get the revenge back on them with this endless deluge of absurd and overbearing regulations that Brussels spews out. And up to a point, Germany, as the most powerful country and one used to regimentation, doesn't matter that much. And the French and Italians don't normally pay any attention to what governments do anyway. But in the case of Britain, they like to be law-abiding, but they don't like to have stupid laws. So I'm oversimplifying, but the point is, the whole European model was social democratic, leveling everything, homogenizing all questions of nationality, and deferring all decision-making to a bunch of faceless bureaucrats from little countries who didn't represent anybody and weren't in a democratic system. And the whole thing is going to blow up. It was wonderful as a common market. It's splendid that these countries that were at war for centuries with each other have buried the hatchet. But as a government, it's a failure.
Yeah, and Conrad, when you look at the economy of the once mighty Germany, it is at, I believe, 0.2%
GDP. Has it come down to that?
0.2%, I believe, last month. Check it, Mike, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. It's pathetic. I mean, it is basically stalled out.
And look, the worrisome thing there is, for most of their history as a federal republic, they had two parties that were reasonably capable of governing. And now it's a very fragmented parliament. And those two parties voting together in a grand coalition of a bare majority. And of the fragmented parts, about 10% is the old communist group in East Germany, completely unacceptable. About 10% are the Greens, who are absolute fanatics in Germany on ecological matters. You can't reason with them. 10% of the German Alternative Party, which most of which is quite sensible, but it does include some, I don't want to be tendentious and say Nazis, but I wouldn't say that that's what they are, but people that are well out of the mainstream in their racial views. And then there's one very sensible small business party. But it's becoming a shaggy situation, and you don't have to remember earlier times in Germany to have reservations about what that country can be like when there isn't an obvious stable government. And this would, if it deteriorates any further, that's where we're going to be. And it is fundamentally dangerous to have, and I'm not suggesting they would ever go back to anything like the Third Reich. I'm certainly not suggesting that. But it is a bad thing and a worrisome thing if the greatest country in Europe is not politically stable.
No. And look, right now, at this moment, I believe, right, that Nigel Farage's Brexit party has eclipsed the Tories in registrations. And this is in
for the European election, yeah.
Right, for the European elections. Obviously not throughout the UK, but in the European election. That's just unbelievable. That's just incredible. And this is a man who, as he said yesterday, we'll play the soundbite. This is Farage talking about his rallies. They're packed. He's drawing huge crowds almost everywhere he goes, and this is what he said.
Here we are with one of the biggest changes in politics that's ever occurred,
okay,
and you're not even interested.
Do you still
What's
want,
wrong with the BBC?
Do you still want to
What
roll,
is wrong with the BBC?
Do you still want to roll back gun controls and reintroduce handguns
well,
to this country?
This sums it up. Do you know, I've been going around the country speaking at PAC rallies every night, and do you know who's not there? The BBC. And from this line of questioning now, I can see why.
Do you still?
You're just not interested, are you?
Do you still feel uncomfortable with foreign languages being spoken on trains?
Let's talk about democracy. Let's talk about trust. Let's talk about competence in politics. This is ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, Conrad, he does what Trump does. I mean, you're not real. You're not a real, honest broker.
Right. I don't know if any of your listeners watch the BBC.
I do.
Yeah, I find it. Look, they're good at some types of programming, and they're good at specialized reporting, but they're quite anti-American, very anti-Israel, completely globalist, hemophiliac bleeding hearts, as President Reagan used to say, with other people's money, of course, and absolute Euro-fanatics. I think the sooner you scrap the British Parliament, retire the Queen, and plunge headlong into the Brussels-led Europe, the better. And the people aren't there. And you know they're suffering the same problems in that country as occur in the United States and elsewhere, where the people don't trust the media, and they're right not to trust them. I don't mean all of them, obviously, but the majority of them.
We're talking to Conrad Black here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. Conrad, and meanwhile, you are formerly a Canadian citizen. You live in Canada, and really interesting things happening in Canada now, especially with Justin Trudeau was the it boy, just seems like 5 minutes ago. And I'm sure he's a nice person and all that jazz, but the discontent risen with him, and now a more China skeptic sentiment is settling in from everything that I'm reading, because it was Canada, I think, was very favorably inclined to accept a lot of Chinese investment, but now they're realizing it comes with strings attached, especially with Trump in power in the United States.
Yeah, well, in the case of Justin, he is a nice guy, and he was a new and pleasant face. I think it was more a question of the previous regime. It had three terms, and they ran a ridiculous re-election campaign, and the former Prime Minister Harper was a pretty good Prime Minister, but he was not Mr. Personality. And so, you know, in a democracy, both sides come to bat, even if you have to wait for it for a while. But he hasn't been an effective leader. They haven't really done very much, and there's been too much just pandering and window dressing and absurd gestures to faddish trends and gender matters and the environment and native people, and not really much policy that anyone can identify with. And taxes are too high and economic growth is too low. And in a democracy, you pay for that. But then add to that, there have been some horrible follow-ups lately where there's an allegation where I have tended to defend the government up to a point, although they've mishandled it, of favoritism to a large company that was otherwise guilty, supposedly, of offenses overseas. But my view is it's not up to us to reform the electoral mores of Libya. And I thought it was sort of nonsense, but it didn't look good. But this latest one where they indicted the head of the Canadian Navy and deputy chief of the Joint Chief, man who'd served 33 years blamelessly on spurious grounds, of which after a year of this nonsense, they acknowledged they had no evidence. That is, I think, potentially extremely damaging to this government. But on the Chinese thing, the igniting point was this woman that the United States government asked to be extradited from Vancouver. It was an executive of Huawei, you know, the high-tech company in China. And the Canadians, I believe, have faithfully followed the Canadian law and are honoring the extradition agreement. But the concern about China hasn't become a huge issue with the public at this point, but it is capable of it. And I think that's not so much following the United States as just legitimate concern about their inroads in this country. I mean, they were rejected some years ago when they tried to buy the entire potash industry. And the then government said, no, we're not going to allow that. So, you know, it hasn't just arisen, but it is something that is increasing as a concern.
Well, they had those arrests of the two Canadians in China this week or a couple of days ago.
Yeah, the Chinese countermeasures are deeply offensive, and that's not the sort of thing that is going to work with this country. I mean, you know, like any self-respecting country, if you just raise the ante and provoke them and do unjust things, they don't capitulate. They take countermeasures themselves. Well, the Chinese have a lot greater investment here than we do there. I mean, they presumably have a basic knowledge of arithmetic.
Well, I think, you know, the trade issue, which doesn't get adequate coverage in the United States, or I should say doesn't get informed coverage oftentimes in the United States, is a huge part of this. I mean, everything from the soybean farmers in Canada to steel. And I don't know. I think that Trump has defanged a lot of folks on the left who supposedly, Conrad, cared so much about human rights when 20 years of evidence is piled up that everything that Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Alan Greenspan were promising when China became a member of the WTO. I mean, these were grandiose promises of a new era for American.
They were taken over the barrel.
Oh, my swindled. God. I love watching those old tapes.
As the same administrations were by the North Koreans.
Yes.
It's an unblemished record of failure and of simply being cheated again and again. And I have to say this, though, and I thought it would be a long time before I did say it. I must commend Chuck Schumer for supporting the president on this one.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's been consistently good on China.
Yep.
And he's seen what China's done to upstate New York, which is, you know, it's the dumping of products, the illegal state subsidies of certain industries. I mean, it's just been it's been devastating for.
Look, I am virtually a lone voice up here. I mean, not I'm exaggerating, but I think if not a minority, at least the most emphatic in saying this, that China cannot actually go through an economic showdown with the United States. And
totally
it is
right.
Still 40% a command economy. They still have 300 million people living the way they did 1,000 years ago. And there are no institutions that anyone has any faith in there except the armed forces. And it's built on debt. I mean, it's a magnificent development story. As an underdeveloped country becoming a largely developed country, it's a fantastic success story. But it's fragile. It's based on mountains of debt put into infrastructure and relying on command economy to work. And the Chinese aren't docile people.
No, so they'll talk a good game about we'll fight to the end, and like they do their big, you know, their big finish.
It's a formidable country, and we have to treat it with care. But fine, they'll fight to the end, but they'll get to the end. They're not as economically. They are. Trump has moved in time. If this had gone on another 10 years, China would be bigger than they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, interesting, extremely interesting development on the Canada-U.S. relationship when Trump called up Trudeau last week, and basically they made a deal on ending the U.S., I think the steel and aluminum tariffs.
Yes.
In Ontario, especially Hamilton, Ontario, you know, has large and very prosperous, important steel plants. And look, this is a good thing
really
about
part
Trump.
Of Greater Toronto, yeah.
Right. And this is so key to our North American strength. I mean, so you can have a strong North America with each country having their own sovereign right to self-determination. I think Trump has shown us that. He wants a strong Mexico and he wants a strong Canada, but it can't be at the expense of all of America's steel and aluminum manufacturing either. But I think he's striking the right balance there.
I think it's fine with Canada, but Canada was always a fair trader. I don't think he ever had a serious grievance with this country. But the Mexicans, I mean, we all hope, we all wish them well and hope it continues to grow more prosperous and more stable. But there really was a legitimate American grievance there. They were enticing American companies to move 10 miles inside the border, leaving unemployment behind, then exploiting free trade to ship free back into the U.S. at a fraction of the wage costs, retain their profits in Mexico and not repatriate them. And then, as a bonus, the Mexicans were passing through up to 1 million illegal people every year into the United States. Well, at some point, I think historians of the future will wonder why. I mean, like what you said earlier about China and I mentioned North Korea. I mean, how did American administrations put up with this nonsense for as long as they did?
Right. Right. Well, look, the U.S., just on the steel and aluminum, and we'll let this go, the U.S. had complained that there have been surges post, extra market surges of steel and aluminum, which obviously depresses the price of aluminum artificially. That had been our complaint. But you're right. I mean, nothing that rose to the level of what we'd seen with the point of origin sourcing of materials going into cars that then come into the United States with, like, no tariffs from Mexico. So it was no comparison whatsoever. But back to China, Conrad, before we let you go on this. This is where the U.S. and Canada has a strong common bond, because both Trudeau and Trump are now mired in this China fight together. I mean, from the Huawei issue with China retaliating against Canada for arresting Meng Wanzhou, and also the Canadian agricultural exports getting hit by China as a result of that, and then Trump working with Trudeau to ease all of these tensions. I think this is good. This is a good moment for our relationship, which is strong before this, but I think it's better now.
Yeah, I know. I think that is right. And it is unfortunate that the Trudeau government started out the trade talks with the U.S. by raising irrelevant matters about employment of women and, comparative pay of women and certain ecological issues that have nothing to do with trade and gender questions generally. I mean, just nonsense, instead of discussing the actual economics. But they got over that, and it seems to be going well now. Look, the fact is, Canada really doesn't ever do anything that the Americans should object to. I mean, we are good neighbors, and we're fair traders, and we're loyal allies, when anything important happens. And the United States, believe it or not, it can occasionally be slightly annoying as a neighbor, but that's slightly annoying. I occasionally point
out...
Don't
hate us because we're beautiful.
No, on the reverse. Everyone likes the United States and admires the force of the country, but I occasionally make the point up here that we could be in the position of Poland historically between the Germans and Russians, and that was really quite complicated.
No. Oh my gosh, Conrad! What is Andrew Scheer have? What, do you know him, the conservative leader?
I know him well.
You know, tell me about him. I don't know him at all.
Well, I think he's a sleeper. You know, I mean, he's not a
chief rival of Trudeau. For everybody listening.
Yeah, he's not a charismatic. Yeah, he's leader of the opposition. He's not a charismatic person like Trudeau was. He could, he should borrow Justin Taylor, I think, and things like that. But he's a younger person who was Speaker of the Parliament here in his 30s, and he is well informed on the issues, socially conservative, very sound. Conservative background without being in any way an extremist, but a man of principle, and because of that he's being portrayed as a sort of medieval bead-rattling Catholic, which, since half the population of this country is nominally Catholic, isn't such a terrible thing anyway, but it's not just. But I think that they are representing him as kind of nebbish, you see. And his strategy was he wasn't going to try and fight it out with Justin for attention until late on, and now he's starting to get more attention. And it is clear in debates, and it will be in Parliament, it will be clear when the debates for the election come up, that he is actually more articulate by some margin than Justin is, and has a better knowledge of the issues than Justin does. So I would say he's got a good chance to win.
Yeah, I'm watching this very closely.
But he's actually a good man. You would like him. You'd find him. The American caricature of a Canadian, a quiet, pleasant, a slightly innocuous person, but he's a good person.
I'm looking forward to meeting him. Conrad, tell us about the president's, I know you've written about it, but tell us about your call that you received from the president. Conrad Black was pardoned last week, a full 100% pardon of his convictions several years ago. What was it, 10 years ago, Conrad? I've tried to block it all out. 12 years ago?
Yeah, 12 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
But you're right. It was 9 years ago we got rid of most of what was left. So it was the amazing shrinking crime, you know, from 17 counts down to 2 counts in stages.
Yeah,
and the two had to be spuriously retrieved after they'd been vacated by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was a travesty from beginning to end. And, you know, as your friend, I hurt right along with you because it was just it was embarrassing that
you were
my country
wonderfully supportive at every stage.
No, but it was infuriating, upsetting, embarrassing for the country that we would have a prosecutorial system that would put someone in his sights, their sights. And not actual crime, but a person, and decide they were going to get in it. And in many ways, this is what happened with the president in the Mueller case. So,
well,
oddly,
in our conversation, it came out that we were, to some extent, dealing with the same people.
Right.
I mean, I had Mueller as director of the FBI, and it wasn't a big case for him, but I'm sure he was aware of it. And Comey is the deputy AG, and I'd say the same. But Comey's best friend, Fitzgerald, who's now representing him as counsel, was the U.S. attorney in Chicago. And he would have been disbarred in Britain or Canada. I mean, we caught them every day lying to the court, but there's never any sanction for it. The president called, and, well, what happened, the lady who answers the phone for me said it's the White House saying they're phoning for the president. So my first impulse was that it was, you know, the London Daily Mail or one of these harum-scarum British tabloids whom I know, you know, playing a trick on me. So I picked up the phone and said hello and just started to say, is this a prank? When the voice said, please hold for the president. And 2 seconds later, he came on. And I knew, unless it was Rich Little, it was the president, you see.
Oh, my God. Rich Little is not even – is he even around any longer? That's a dated reference.
But somebody – you know, some of these people do wonderful impersonations.
Yes.
Conrad,
how are you? Go ahead.
Fine, thanks. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, actually, he said, is that the great Lord Black? Anyway, but then he said a few things that made it clear that he was – you know, he was up on our on the application, and so it was certainly him. But once he said what he was going to do, we had a bit of conversation, and we talked about the methods of precisely the same people who've been bedeviling him. And it is a terrible thing when there's an uncontrolled prosecutorial class. I mean, I this is a big subject, and it's too late to get into it in this call, but I don't know what happened to the Bill of Rights. I mean, how did you end up with a 99% conviction rate, 97% without a trial? And why aren't more people objecting to it? Those are North Korean rates of conviction.
It is a scandal. I mean, what happened to you, it was – I'm so sick of using Kafkaesque because I feel like I really overuse that word.
Yeah, we got to give equal time to Orwell and Kessler.
Oh, yes. Okay. Look at my Orwell, too. That's the other one I use too often. But no, but they're the same people or people of the same type of thinking, which is I'm going to build my career on this conviction. This guy is too big for his britches. We're going to bring him down, and it's going to launch my career into another stratosphere. That's how
and
so much of what happens.
The absence of evidence is not indicative, as most sane people would think, of an absence of guilt. The absence of evidence is proof of their fiendish cunning in disguising and hiding the evidence.
What did they accuse you of that first press conference, Conrad? A $60 million corporate kleptocracy?
A public company is a piggy bank. They accused me of wasting $400 million.
Oh, $400 million.
Yeah, they got it down to $285,000, which I did receive, but the judge found that it was a clerical error by the company secretary, but it was resurrected as a crime for me.
And on the basis of that, they
hung a further claim of obstruction of justice for as I had to move offices under court order. I was helping move boxes out under security cameras that I had installed with the agreement of the acting president of the company and the chief representative of the court-appointed inspector, who incidentally ran up bills of $25 million and never found one misspent cent. I mean, what was an obstruction conviction in Chicago, redeemed by that megalomaniac Posner after it fell down, it was something that the court here said was not a cause of action and not a violation of any document retention order.
Now, weren't you moving like some of your old letters and plaques
letters
and stuff?
Letters of condolence when my brother died and things like that. Yes.
Yeah, obstruction. It's
a photograph of my mother, for God's sakes.
Yeah, it's funny, but it was horrific, horrific. And where do you go to get? I mean, they take your money. You spend all this money on legal bills. It ages you, although you look great. All of that. But Patrick Fitzgerald is Jim Comey's lawyer. Patrick Fitzgerald was U.S. attorney who went after Conrad. And it's just this never.
Libby before that, and
Scooter
and,
Libby.
You know,
thank
you.
That
was all uncooked evidence.
Yeah, Scooter Libby as well, another person who deserved a pardon, and Bush gave him a commutation. But Donald Trump just does the right thing. And there was a great piece in the Wall Street Journal, Conrad Black deserved a pardon, phenomenal piece. I'll make sure it's posted on lauraingram.com. If people did not read it,
and that editorial they ran on Thursday in the Journal was terrific.
Terrific.
Friday,
it was it's like the best thing. I mean, I was mad that I didn't write it, but I don't have time to write like I used to now. But Conrad, I do think that I win the award of making the most gratuitous references to your case. Like, in like weird times on my show, I would say, yeah, just like what they did to Conrad Black. Like, I would sneak in references. Yeah.
Someone always tells me about them if I haven't seen them myself. No,
it was like a drinking game. Like, is Laura going to mention Conrad today on the show? It was funny. But no, because as my mother used to say, Conrad, it burns me up when I see this type of injustice. But I can't wait to see you. I can't wait to see you in the United States. I can't wait to have you back on the show. Thank you for what you write, who you are, and just what you do. And, I just adore you. So thank you for everything, Conrad.
Well, it's for me to thank you, Laura. You are You are a lioness and an inspiration.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Conrad, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. His book was phenomenal, Donald J. Trump, A President Like No Other, came out last year. And remember, thanks again to all of our great sponsors for making this podcast possible, Pluto TV, Cerovital, and Delta Animal Rescue. Those are companies you should support. We love them, you'll love them, and we only partner with the best of the best. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast, America Now and Forever. See you next time.